Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to All Rather Mysterious, the podcast that aims to unlock the mysteries of the past with the key of fact. My name is John Rain.
My name is Eleanor Morton.
My name is David Reed.
Please join us as we present to you mysteries that have baffled the world.
You add any noises?
What about a door creaking?
You don't have to do it.
That weird kadunk that lights going off makes for some reason in films.
All Rather Mysterious.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
If there's a family down the road who shaved their head in week two, you thought he's fucking peaked too soon.
No, that's peaking.
Yeah.
That's cannibalism by week three.
It's awful. Well, how do you normally begin? Do you just go...
Hello and welcome to The Fear, a podcast about the overlap between comedy and horror. My name's Sarah Morgan.
Hello.
You're right.
I'm good. How are you?
Hello, listeners. I know there hasn't been a podcast around these parts for since the accident. But two things have happened. Many things have happened, but two of the things that have happened. One, it's Halloween. Important. And number two, my friend, the screenwriter and now author, Will McLean, has written a book. A spooky book.
Hooray.
Sorry. And we're here to celebrate it with gentle, low expectation. Hooray.
British enthusiasm as well. Yes, that's good.
Every episode of The Fear, I ask a funny person whose work I admire to come on and talk about what scares them. And I asked them to bring in three things: a fear from their childhood, their favourite scary moment from film or TV, and a fear or phobia they live with now. And we unpack those three things in a hopefully judgment-free environment. Author Will McLean, author of The Apparition Phase, available in all bookshops.
All bookshops.
All of
good
the bookshops.
Ones, bad ones. Different ones.
Yes. I am two-thirds of the way through it. And,
good.
And it's very good. It's very good. It's unputdownable, I would say, but I've had to put it down to talk to you, ironically. Yeah.
that's good. That's the best adjective I can hear, really. That's marvellous. So, yeah, I do. I love horror. And I'm not, people go, oh, you must be an expert. No, I'm not an expert. There are experts. We know a lot of experts in these kind of things, and they're all...
Too many experts these days.
They all know what they're talking about, and it's like I just like it. I like the feel of it. I like that in horror, we'll come to this later, but you can tell ambitious stories and you can tell interesting stories and you can tell them in a way that's more direct or more coded. You know, you can turn the volume up and down on them. They're just malleable and they're brilliant. And I really, the opportunities to do that are great. So,
I mean, my big question is really sort of what inspired you to write this particular story, because it's clearly grounded in, I'm assuming, a bit of realism of your childhood, a childhood we kind of share. I think you're a little bit older than me, but I grew up in the 80s, you grew up in the 70s, but we both have a shared overlap of things like The Osborne Book of Ghosts.
We do. The book makes me sound older than I am, because I was born in 73. So a lot of the stuff is like, it's not, you know, it's a folk memory of the 70s. But
there's so much stuff which it was. I mean, I grew up in the stuff I remember vividly is stuff that happened in 1982 and I couldn't possibly have seen. But you have these, as you say, the almost ghost memories or a half-remembered thing or apocryphal playground versions of these things. And they've become more powerful because of that.
Bob Fisher at the 14 Times wrote this brilliant article called The Haunted Generation. It was about the last analog generation. So people, as we were talking about just then, you know, if you watch something on television, there was no guarantee you would ever see it again. Mm-hmm. So your memory of it was really important. Mm-hmm. And that's gone. That feeling has gone. The media itself is haunted. It's a haunted thing. And he wrote this brilliant article about this. And there was the next month, there was dozens of letters. The reaction to it was incredible. Mm. And I just thought, God, people really, you know, they they don't know this as well as I thought they did, in terms of, because a lot of people were, you know, like, oh, I remember, half remember this thing. And it's like, well, that's,
yeah. I remember when Phil Kool's head exploded doing a Paul Daniels impression and it haunted my dreams, or Kenny Everett feeding himself into a mincing machine. Those are two of them. That's just two off the top of my head. There's so many of those.
And those two, I remember people telling me about in the playground the next day, just going, you know, because I missed one of them. I think I saw the Everett one, and they were just going, Phil Kool's head. And I was like, there's no way they would have broadcast that. Yes. And it's like, you know, and then it becomes a massive thing in your mind, and it's, you know, it's that was all gone, because you can just send it to someone and they can watch it instantly. Yeah, you know, so those that whole lag between what you saw and then what you think you saw, and all that, and it does tie in very explicitly to ghosts. There's a and there's a lot been written about this. Mark Fisher, particularly, is, you know, rest his soul, is very eloquent about the connection between analog media and ghosts, and the way we remember things, and the usefulness as a ghost as a metaphor for how we understand things, and of that particular vintage. And there's a woman called Kirsten Gallineau who wrote a brilliant book called High Static Deadlines, which is specifically about sort of audio hauntology and recording, you know, which is so basically he wrote,
when we
get
onto the stone tape, this is gonna
we do
be, we will but the stone tape feature, as does many other kind of spooky in the book, because so the plot for listeners who might be tempted to go and get this,
I was stuck on how to begin this thing, and then I called my sister and we were chatting about that article, and we remembered that we faked a ghost photograph when we were kids, or we were teenagers, and it was crap. It was absolutely awful. We did chalk something on a wall, but the end result was like really quite eerie. It looked really odd. You couldn't really tell what you were looking at. And then we just forgot about it for ages, because that's where it's divorced from what happens in the book. In the book, twins called Tim and Abby, and they are unusual children who are obsessed with ghosts and folklore and esoteric interests, and they share these very macabre obsessions, or, you know, obsessions that other people think are macabre.
Anyone who listens to this podcast will probably empathize and identify a lot with their obsessions.
Exactly. But, you know, obsessions that will mark you out as different, and which, as we say in the book, I don't think in the 70s they really were. They were, you know, or in that, or in childhood, I don't think they are. And we join them as, just as they're 13, almost 14, and they are beginning to grow apart as people. So they do this. This is almost the last throw of the dice for their weird interests, and they fake this ghost photograph, and then it doesn't go well. The results of that then have repercussions beyond. It doesn't really pan out well for them. Like I say, my sister and I did this ghost photograph, and we were about, I think we were older. I think we were just bored. And then we forgot about it for ages. And then my sister found it years later when she was doing, I think, a foundation course in photography. And she took it in and showed it to her tutor. And he was terrified. He was just like, I spoke about it recently. Apparently he came back to her and went, I can find no evidence of fakery in this photograph. And this is like, well, that's good. Good for you. That's, but it's, I remember it being, quite a bad photograph, but I just thought as a starting point for a story, that's really interesting.
Yeah, no, it's great. And it's so wrapped up in that sort of gleeful childhood kind of fascination. This time last year, in fact, I think it was, me and Kate Hodges did an episode of The Fib to talk about the Osborne World of the Unknown ghosts, ghosts, and something about when you're a kid and your mind is so open to the fact that the facts presented in these books are sort of,
well, they're facts. I mean, that's it. They were presented then as and that thing in the book where Abby and Tim think that science is going to shine a light on ghosts sometime soon. That was a real thing. People really thought that science was just going to crack it, you know. Mm. And there's still some, you know, I think just nobody will touch that with a barge pole these days. But the science of it is quite interesting. You know, you get people talking about quantum nanotubules, and you get people talking about infrasound and all these other things, and they are interesting, but Yeah, it's
so this, but you look like a man who really wants to believe that it is actually like.
No, I don't. I don't. I'm not really. I'm sort of. I quite like the idea that you are, as a human being, you've got these five rubbish senses. You don't. You've got about seven or eight, but you've got. You know, your perception for understanding the world is really limited. So for anyone to go, I completely understand how everything works, it's absolute nonsense. Mm-hmm. But that said, I just don't want to get involved. There's a lot of, in world of woo, basically. So, yeah. And it is just opening the door to a whole world of, you know. So it's best to stay on the fence. It's like it is best to, you know, once again, agnosticism is the strong position here.
Open mind's always the useful thing in this world.
Yes.
Are you, is Halloween cancelled for you this year? Are you Halloween-y?
We are very Halloween-y in this house. We are going to do, because my daughter watches a lot of Sarah and Duck, and still does, because she's Quack. Four.
If you're a parent and someone says Sarah and Duck, you literally have to be like, quack, it's
that's
the shaven.
For the duck heads out there.
It's one for the parents.
Yes. because on that, they do a really gentle version of that called Boo Night. She's obsessed with Boo Night.
Oh,
we've taken her trick-or-treating a couple of times, and she absolutely loved it. But we're not going to be able to do that this year, so we're going to do something at home.
Are you going to do pumpkin trails? That's what
we already have done. Yeah, we stuck a pumpkin in the window. Lovely. If that's what that is. Yeah.
So what you're supposed to do, in case any listeners aren't aware of what you're meant to do this year, so that we can have some kind of Halloween, so the virus doesn't win, is you put a pumpkin out, and then you walk around your neighbourhood, and when you see a pumpkin, you give your kid a sweet. So we all get to.
That's a lovely idea.
Join in. I like that. Yeah, it's nice. The first thing I'd like to talk about is the choice that you made for your favourite scary moment from film or TV.
Mm-hmm.
And you chose pretty much the entirety of The Stone Tape.
I did. This is Nigel Neal's The Stone Tape from 1972. Christmas Day it was broadcast. Broadcast on Christmas Day on BBC Two. You would not make, you know, that's impossible. Mm. Unthinkable now. I love The Stone Tape. I first saw it when I was about 15, I think. When I was a teenager, there was a bunch of Doctor Who fans, primarily in Liverpool, who would meet up and they would just share stuff, and they would occasionally book like a room in a hotel where they just show things. And it was, it sounds dodgy. It sounds like I've described it wrongly, but it was like, that was the thing. And it's the only way you would see stuff. And I went along cause they were showing stuff that I liked and wouldn't otherwise been able to see. And one of those, and I'd never heard of The Stone Tape, and someone just put it on. It was absolutely mesmerizing. And that's the point of like having belonging to one of those things, is that you'd come along and other enthusiasts would bring stuff and you'd all share stuff. And that blew my mind, really. And I just remember thinking it was, and still do. I mean, I watched it yesterday for this, and it stands up so well. It's just such a brilliant piece of work. We should probably tell people at home who aren't old like me what it's about.
It's one of those ones where I knew it by reputation. I knew it was sort of in the canon of. So I watched it last night. It was the first time my wife watched it, and I loved it.
Brilliant.
So let's do the synopsis first.
Okay. The Stone Tape is set in a Victorian house, a large Victorian mansion in which a company called Ryan Electrics are searching, as Mark Fisher notes, apparently coincidentally, for a new recording medium. And they discover that the room they're designated as the computer room isn't ready yet because the workmen refuse to work in there because it's haunted. And one member of the team, Jill! Everyone shouts Jill at some point in this production. Jane Asher plays Jill, and she immediately sees a ghost in there and hears one. And the sound design, because it's about sound, is absolutely staggering. It, to this day, it's absolutely amazing. So she has this shattering experience of seeing a ghost and hearing a ghost scream. Shares this theory with the others, this experience with the others, and they develop this theory, which is a pre-existing theory. T.C. Lethbridge popularized it, I believe, which is that ghosts are recordings, that they are embedded in the stone of a building, and that they're not animate in the way we'd understand it. They're just recordings. They're doomed to repeat. Which is a really interesting idea. It's now called the stone tape theory. It's now popularly referred to as the stone tape theory because of this. But the team set about trying to exploit it as a recording medium. And initially it brings them almost to breaking point, and they delete the first layer of recording on there. It's just very strange. So the woman that, Jane Asher's scene, they remove that from
the ghost of a maid,
yes, and then they discover that the room is much older than the rest of the house, and eventually it builds to a spooky, it doesn't go well, like it's a ghost story.
They peel away more and more layers of ghosts until it's just ghosts all the way down.
solid ghosts.
What I loved about it, it's just a core, a solid, it's like scraping off a layer of wallpaper and there's another layer of wallpaper, but it's ghosts, and they just keep on going with ghosts. But I'm afraid I had to do a shrill feminist reading of everything I watch, but this is actually like it's such an amazing, proper ghost lighty. I've not invented a genre, it's pretty much all ghost stories. It's a beautiful gaslighting story of a woman not being believed for most of the thing. So she's in a relationship, or was in a relationship, with this guy called Brock. Rhesus Smith character.
He is. He communicates entirely by shouting.
Even the stone's got it. It's just very old.
1880?
That was when they paddled it in, but those walls are a lot older than the rest of the house. They've just been built onto. In fact, they must have been knocked down and rebuilt and generally mess around a lot in the last 1,000 years.
What?
Oh, yes, the foundations might be Saxon.
Saxon?
Just an amateur opinion.
Oh, my God.
Informed amateur.
If you're right, you see what this means, don't you? They'll be in here, the environment boys, the conservationists, nailing their little notices on the door and writs, and they could stop everything if they got onto this.
What about the architect?
That architect, didn't he spot anything?
Not him, he quit.
Right. If we move fast, get everything concreted over, get the machines moved in. Where are the men now?
Working on the back.
Come on. Don't worry, love. You'll get your storage room.
Yeah.
That's what he does.
Ryan Electronics are there because they're trying to record the sound of, what is it, the ring cycle in a ball bearing. They're trying to find new technology.
A thing that nobody would ever want.
Yeah, so. He's trying to find a new way of recording sound so that he can, oh God, and there's some very eggy stuff about beating the Japanese to the audio recording market, which is very important in the 70s.
That was. That's not aged well.
It's
Michael Bryant. Sorry, I was looking that up. It's Michael Bryant.
Wonderful. He looks like a Rhys Shearsmith character, small shouting man.
If Rhys Shearsmith was Doctor Who and he regenerated into Andy Nyman, he'd be Bryant.
Or if they had a baby one in the lab and they had a baby, they bundle-flyed into a little...
I was going to say that's a sexy answer, but it's really not.
I mean, it depends what you're into. Wears very tight yellow trousers and his belt done up too tight like Jeremy Clarkson does, the way that men do to sort of prove they're still a size 32 waist or something. So he looks like he's about to burst all the time. He's like a barber.
He's angry throughout the whole thing.
Furious.
He's furious all the time. And he's a horrible piece of work. I mean, that's the other good thing about
that's
it.
What's wonderful about it. He starts off being... So the sort of implication is he's had an affair with Jill.
Yeah.
That's over, but he wants her to keep working for him because of her mind. He says something wonderful. Where is it? Hang on. He says, I wrote it down because I loved it.
He shouts it.
He shouts it. He says,
you know what this is about? You're getting at me. Mind you, I quite enjoyed your previous ploys. How Christine and the kids, how Timothy's mumps, how's the dog's toothache? Oh, my Jilly. You're a very female one. I need you. I know you weren't keen to transfer, but I need you for your brain.
He says something like they're related, you know, we're not shagging. He doesn't say we're not shagging anymore. He says something about the relationship being over, and then he says, but you're a very female one and I need you for your brain.
Yes, it's a brilliant line.
Your brain, because she's good at computers, which then was all you needed to say. Show her typing a lot and then say you're good at computers, and they needed warehouse to keep the bits of computer in.
And what we were talking about earlier, which is the fetishizing of analog technology. This is the analog ghost story par excellence. They've got a computer that obviously needs a room for it to be in.
Yeah, like in Superman 2, that needed a continent.
It's so big. And at one point, the computer's teleprinter is so loud you can't hear the dialogue.
Oh, it's great. And
Jane Ash is really trying to compete with this, this Olivetti typewriter. Yeah. But there's loads of that in it. It's all brilliant. And the title sequence is magnificent.
Oh, it's great. But it starts off with her. It starts off in a state of horror. That's wonderful. There's no leading you into it. She pulls up to the house, parks her car, and immediately two massive trucks, which are sort of symbols of the future or whatever the metaphor is, come reversing around the corner and nearly squash her in her tiny car, her tiny feminine car.
Yes.
And then no one believes her or gives a shit when she tells them. And immediately we sort of started that this is the whole film is going to be this woman trying patiently to explain stuff. And she's the only girl as well, which I loved. She's like,
That's great. I realized halfway through telling the synopsis there that I'd missed out on that very beginning bit, which is crucial that she starts in a state of absolute fear.
Yeah. And Brock. Right. Peter Brock assumes that it's because she wants to shag him again and she's a woman with a feminine brain. I looked up the script. Have you ever read the script?
No, I haven't.
I love reading scripts. I'm just going to... Sorry, I've got to open it on history. Here you go. Sorry, horror lair. There we go, scripts. There are two vans emblazoned Rhine Electrical products. One is unloaded, the other is just finishing. Men are shifting bulky apparatus onto trolleys and moving it inside the house. The car driver is Jill Greeley, about 30. There is a very feminine, strong directness about her, so that what she seems far more important than what she does. What she does is computer programming.
That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. That's sort of weirdly... I don't know. It's a very weirdly progressive and yet awful description.
It's good screenwriting. I love it. Do you want to hear Peter Brock? By the way, introducing characters is really hard, and I think I love it when you find a good one in a script. Like Peter Brock, age 35, director of research for Rhine Electrics. He is a man with a lot of drive, his temperament all upswing and downbeat. At the moment, he's on a big upswing, arriving to take over his new establishment.
That's great. Honestly, the characters are really well drawn. It's got so many good character actors in it as well. And Tom Chadbon's in there, who delivers the famous line when they're really pushing it to the limit. And he goes, it's in the computer.
Oh, that's such a great line. Yeah, because Brock essentially goes mad, doesn't he? Because there's this whole amazing subplot, which is that, they're there to record audio stuff, find the new technology, the new thing, beat the Japanese to the new technology.
Yes.
Happen to come across a ghost and think, well, that'll be a new way of recording stuff. they actually explain it so well. I mean, I was fine. The stone records a thing. Mm-hmm. They get very excited and have a big party, which actually looks like quite a fun party. All the men in this throughout are constantly roaring. They're just roaring at everything.
They're all. It's constant bants from the men.
Yeah.
The first time you meet them, they're doing a practical joke. It's horrible, and it's just like God, these people are dreadful.
Yes, they're all dreadful, and yet
Jane Asher in there. It's like
poor Jane Asher.
She's absolutely brilliant. Yes.
Remember when they go to the pub, that's the only other female character in the whole thing. It's a wonderful... Mm. This fact, there's two wonderful barmaids who I assume are meant to be a couple. I don't know. There's something going on there. But they're...
Very hard.
One is incredibly blousy. Mm. The big pink blouse. Huge pink blouse. Huge blonde hair. Huge cleavage. Pouring pints. And then a sort of butch one turns up, and they both tell stories about how they used to be good time girls up at the house that was haunted with the Americans.
Yeah.
Ooh, good time girls.
It's got that brilliant thing that Nigel Neal does, in that which is where someone throws up a really interesting thing and then it doesn't get talked about. So the woman goes, Eisenhower came there once, and they just don't mention it again. It's not important to the story. It's a whole story in its own right somewhere else, but it's not in the Stone Tape. And it's like, I love that. It's so... You know, from a screenwriting point of view, that's brilliant.
Well, it's the lovely what do they call it? The chuffer, the sort of dialogue that isn't important, but is so important because it's not important. The sort of it's the calm before the storm, which we haven't had so far in the script. And then we get to the pub, and it's just a little bit of comic relief, a little bit of lightness, and then there's a haunted barman who has broken from his experiences in the mansion, and has to be persuaded. And it's clear that he has experienced the ghosts in the room.
But the you asked me to isolate one moment from it, and it would definitely be, and this is the thing that stayed with me when I saw it when I was 15, and then for years afterwards, was the very end where Jill is working late because she thinks she can, they've been told to sort of scale down what they're doing, and she... Yeah, so she's working late, and then she goes to the room, and she comes out, and she sees, and this, I'd forgotten how brilliant this sequence is and how unnerving. She sees these two dots, these two red lights in the darkness in the corridor, and they look like eyes. Obviously, that's the... And they're just... The way they appear is brilliant. I don't know how it was done. I presume it's just CSO or something, but they flip up, and it's terrifying. And all of a sudden, you're like... And then for all of this... pseudoscience that holds is the glue that holds this thing together, all of a sudden you've got this you've got your ghost, you know, and they've really earned it. And then she flees back into the room, and then the room is different, the room is reconstructed in the way it would have been when the maid died, and then she sees these things that are the shapeless green things which look like readings of sound anyway. So the whole thing is...
That's what's so wonderful. Yeah, you can't say what they are, but you know that they have life, presence.
Yeah.
But there's nothing about them that suggests they're a face. There's no faces, there's nothing.
No. But it's malevolent as well. You're told that, that later on, you're told that the last reading in the room was 7,000 years old. So you're looking at something very old and new. But it's... People talk about the special effects in the 70s. No, it's very sneered at. But here is just... You know, they've made it almost like a piece of art, and it's just brilliant. It's so unnerving and using those very limited effects to their capacity, really, and making them as abstract as possible. And then, it's just amazing. And it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make any...
Oh, there's a bit where she's climbing up the steps, which we've seen throughout have no top to them, that they whatever floor was that was there once has now rotted away, so it's just a set of stone steps which we see the maid falling off over and over again, this ghost that's sort of trapped in her little time loop, and it's very sad and not scary. It's sad, you feel sad for the maid.
Yes, that's really important. Yeah,
because at this point Jill is feeling nothing but empathy for this this girl. There's nothing bad about the ghosts until Brock shouts at waves her off, and that brings them through. Yeah, because he unleashes the monsters. That's what's so important about it, is his greed to beat out a man who wants to invent a sophisticated kind of washing machine, which is the weirdest and yet
fine. Classic motivation for
storyline about there being a man. Anyway. Sorry, to go back to the... I know, but I had to remind myself that that's what the motivation is. It's fine. It's completely fine.
Totally fine.
She climbs the stairs and then keeps climbing. Then she sort of starts climbing up, and then there's this, what to me looked like very early green screen. There's something really weird about the texture of the wall as she's climbing up, and because it's...
It's great. It's like and also, why is that wall there? Why is any of this there? And it seems like an open sky, and it's just...
Yes, that's it. It's like a landscape.
Yeah, but, and then she falls off the, which is, you know, it's not a brilliantly realised effect, but it doesn't really matter at that stage.
Well, she has the same death as the maid, and yes. You know, so there's a nice echo there. And then it keeps going is the weird thing. That's what's odd about it. Is it's sort of a bit like Psycho, and that you think, should it, you know, how come this is still going? And then it becomes Brock's story.
It doesn't pointlessly keep going, though. It does. No. You get the thing that Brock is such an unpleasant person that he lies basically at Jill's inquest and says that she was mentally unstable, which is a great sort of, you know, note for both of those characters, really, that she's driven and brilliant and he's horrible and isn't and will lie.
And her last words are Peter, which is...
Yeah, that's pretty bad. Yeah. but also then you get the final kicker, which is, it could be cheesy in anyone else's hands, I think, but Peter Brock heads back to the room, presumably to shout at it some more, and he's Jill, and Jill's last moments are embedded in the stone as well.
Yeah.
So it's just, I mean, it's a very poetic ending, but it's also, there's just so much in it. There's so much in it about recorded sound, about men and women, about history, about the abuses of history, about commercialism, about the, and also about the 70s, the fears of, you know, the Japanese are coming.
Yeah.
Everything. It's everything you need to know about what we now call hauntology. Popular hauntology, but it is just all in there. It's brilliant. It's
all of television history is contained within the Box of Delights.
It was happening in front of us.
Incredible.
In our living rooms. It was amazing.
Guests pick their favourite television moment
and tell us why they love it.
And is this the episode where Daisy's just been for the interview at the Woman's Magazine?
Flaps.
That's it, Flaps.
Yeah.
Named one of Radio Times' best podcasts of the year.
I don't understand people who don't see the joy in drawing the curtains, mug of hot chocolate and something nice on TV. Like, what could be nicer than that?
Than having a snuggle.
Exactly.
Nostalgia in bite-sized chunks.
Box of Delights
from Great Big Owl.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
It's so straight as well and so unwinking for that time. There's no camp to it whatsoever, not a hint of it. The washing machine stuff, there's an enormous, even louder shouting man, Strickland, coming in to...
It's Dennis from Terry and June.
It could be a Fry and Laurie sketch.
We should point out, because we keep mentioning the washing machine, we should point out for listeners at home that the Peter Brock's business rival is working on a washing machine that sorts... dyes. It's never really made clear.
It's a very sophisticated washing machine in different ways.
And that's one of these two projects is going to save Ryan Electric. So it's 50-50, which the boss is going to back.
Yeah.
And eventually the guy who, the even shoutier man with the washing machine, cracks it, and then he becomes the favourite.
And it's great because he's enormous and he looks like he's sort of going off to explore the Arctic or something. He doesn't look like a businessman.
Yeah, he does. He looks like a sort of a cheap lion you'd hire for a children's party, you know. But every time you see him as well, he's working with dye all the time, he's got different coloured dyes on his hand. The first time you see him, you get no explanation. So he's just got red dye on his hands.
I was
really
wondering
weird.
If that was my telly. I was like, and then it was like, oh, is it a metaphor? Is he
Is he? Well, I mean, I think it is at that point. But then later on, it's just, you know, he's got he's just got dye on his hands. But it's just great. There's just so much in it, and I'm watching it again, and this is the hallmark of anything good. I think is you watch it again, and it's different. You're different and it's different. And I found that last night. There was so much more in it than I'd remembered there being. And there's so many little bits that don't go anywhere that are just really resonant. There's that bit where they find out that they find when they take the partition down in the haunted room, which has been there for centuries, screaming.
Oh, when he kicks in the kicks in.
Yeah, Peter Brock kicks it in because he's so furious because he's got all that pent up anger. But behind it, they find 30 cans of Spam.
And the letters of Father Christmas,
as someone says. And it turns out, and that's just a kind of throwaway thing. And later on, you find out that the letter is a letter to the ghost.
From a little child. Yeah.
Yeah. Christmas. I can't remember precisely what it says.
Could you not? Like, it's something like, can you go away? It's something really.
Leave me alone. It's plaintive and horrible. There's a bit where one of the team says, we just found some cans of Spam. And somebody says, maybe they were feeding the ghost. And then Jane Asher kind of whispers, maybe they were. Well, perhaps they were. You know, maybe this child, and it just sketches in that little child, or maybe one of the Americans, and it, you know, who had stationed there during the war. I did notice the other thing as well is when the one of the good time girls in the pub is talking about the black serviceman she dated during the war. She says he was always talking about guppies.
That's right.
And then she says, oh, duppies he meant. And it's a really niche term, duppies. It's like it means ghost. It's a ghost thing.
Whoa.
And it's just, and it's not explained. A duppy is, I think it's duppy is, isn't it West African, I think? It's, should probably look this up. But it's a term for like an unquiet spirit. And it's like, that's amazing.
I didn't know that.
And it's not explained in the screen.
No, because I just remember
confusing on screen.
Guppies are fish.
It's a fish woman.
Peter, not John, sorry. Yeah, Peter bellowing back at her. Guppies are fish.
You're thinking of Fry and Laurie now.
I know. It is so Fry and Laurie. Yeah. Damn Marjorie.
We're standing in my children, John. I'm trying to look at Duppy now. There we are.
Duppy, so, yeah. Can I tell you my favourite Peter moment is when Jane Asher, Jill! Oh, actually, no, there's two. The scariest bit is when she's telling him about a ghost and he's just sort of acting like she's faking it because he didn't give her a lift. And he kisses her hair and he goes, Jill. That is scarier than seeing a ghost. Jill. And the other bit is when he finally, because another man has seen the ghost, believes in ghosts.
Yes,
finally, it's confirmed by a non-hysterical man.
It's very much in character for Peter. That
it's perfect. Yeah, it's some the one nice person in it is Collie. Is he Collie? Is that his name?
Yes.
He's a nice man who believes Jill because he convinces Peter that the ghost is real. And Peter hears the ghost, and I don't think he ever sees the ghost, does he? He's not sensitive enough to see it. He hears the ghost. And he has this line where he goes, this isn't some little shade. You couldn't get into heaven because the pearly gates were shut. This is something else, something interesting.
Because those things...
It's not some fucking bird who's fallen off a step or something boring. It's a maid.
Not proof of the afterlife. It means we can we can start recording Mark Bolan on a stone.
We can get a ball bearing with a fucking ring cycle on it.
That's the interesting thing here.
We'll listen to fucking Emerson, Lake and Palmer.
What's also good about it is the theory behind it, all the stone tapes stuff is endlessly interesting, and it's much more interesting just being like a dead person, because it struck me this time watching it that Jill doesn't know the limits of what they're doing, so she doesn't know whether she pities this woman who might simply be a recording, but she's also like a person. She died.
Yeah,
these are her last moments of distress, and only Jill feels remotely respectful towards that. And also this idea that is in it, which is a brilliant idea, that you need a human nervous system for playback, which is astonishing. It's absolutely brilliant. No, it's like, because one of the team is completely unaffected by it, doesn't see anything, doesn't hear anything, and that's great too, that you've got this, and they all hear different things. It's just great. It's just so, much there to explore.
He suggests Peter Brock's pitch is a 13-channel earring that you wear in your ear, and you'd be able to. And then he goes, I'm poking everyone and going, you're Strictly Come Dancing. It doesn't say Strictly Come Dancing. He goes, you're Come Dancing on here, Coronation Street here. It's really modern.
Yeah. It is really modern. Yeah. Or Love Island. Which is, yeah. It's
Keith and Paddy's movie show.
Naked Attraction.
It's such a modern. It's really because it's about modernity, laughing in the face of history and plowing it to the ground without considering the consequences. It doesn't age. There's nothing old fashioned about it. Even the giant computers don't feel old fashioned.
No, they don't. And M.R. James said that you should always try and set ghost stories in the past. And from our point of view, Stone Tape is in the past, but you forget at the time that it was completely contemporaneous.
Okay, so I asked you to tell me what you were scared of as a child, and you replied with being stranded on another planet.
I did, because I had a lot of childhood fears, and I didn't want this to be dreadful listening for people. I didn't want it to be too heavy, and I didn't want to go too far into my own life. So I did choose one thing that was a big thing, and it sounds like quite an abstract fear, but this is rooted in growing up watching Doctor Who. This is late 70s, early 80s Doctor Who, and it would always stress me out massively if they lost the TARDIS. And this is missing from new Doctor Who, where they go, everything in the era of the mobile phone, everything is connected. So in Doctor Who, everyone's got a mobile phone. His companions have a space phone. It's all pretty safe. But back then, there was this idea that if Tom Baker lost the TARDIS, he was screwed. That would be it. You'd have to go live and die somewhere billions of years away from where you were born.
Yeah,
it would just be. You know, and that fear of being isolated. I don't know where's that gone? Where's that fear? I think because everything is connected now, and it's you know, we don't lose things in the way we used to. And I keep harping on about this, but it is a thing.
The idea that you're stuck and you're there and that's it.
And it would stress me out in any adventure story where people went to another world. You'd be like, you're so. This is it for you now. And it would really, as a kid, by any means certain that people are going to get out of these situations.
You don't know about happy endings,
You don't. So you're like, God, this is, at the end of it, you go, that was close for the doctor. It never is. But it's just that idea that you could be you'd just be stranded in an environment that was so hostile and unfriendly. And it was a real thing as a kid. I remember it was just a bit real.
Were you scared of, were you worried about abduction?
No, I wasn't, because we were part of that generation where stranger danger was absolutely hammered into us. And I did, when we went on holiday.
I'm an alien abduction, but I didn't.
Oh, I see. Oh my God. I went really dark there.
I mean, that would have been, that was a lot.
Should we start that? Let's start that again.
I think it was quite funny, but Were you worried about alien abduction?
No, it wasn't really on my radar back
just
then.
Just get fucked off a stranger.
being murdered by a stranger was a big theme back then. but alien abduction, no, I was. It wasn't a thing until. The 90s, it's Whitley Strieber who popularizes abduction.
That's right.
In the popular imagination. So it's not really a thing that happened to people before then.
How are you getting to these planets in your?
I would just because when you're a kid, you just think, what if, and you think, what if I'm whisked to another dimension by Russell T. Davis. Always said the thing about Doctor Who was, he said, I didn't like Star Trek because I wasn't in the Navy. He said, because I couldn't join them on their adventures because I wasn't in the Space Navy. Yeah. Whereas Doctor Who could land tomorrow. And it wasn't that I believed Doctor Who was real. It was, I believed that, the world was strange and unknowable, and that you might go on a Time Bandit style adventure, and that's in Time Bandits as well, that fear of like, oh, I'm abandoned. He ends up abandoned at the end anyway. It's spoilers, but it's just I don't know where that's gone. Yeah, as a child, you know, you think these things seem very possible, that you might go on an adventure and you'll just never get home. You will never get home again.
So that was it was the fear of so you, as a Doctor Who fan as a child, what was your what was your big scare? Who was your scariest?
I think it's very unfashionable to say this, but I think it probably was the Daleks, because they were...
That unfashionable? I like that there's fashion trends in...
Yeah, in what you're afraid of. But they just weren't... The reason that they've succeeded where a lot of things haven't and they've endured is because they're not human. There's no reference point. Somebody once said they look like every piece of equipment that could hurt a child. And I think that's very good. And where I lived, where I grew up in... between where I lived in Seacombe on the Wirral and Birkenhead. If we went to Birkenhead to go get the overground, this is a boring bit of geography, we'd have to walk through a street in Birkenhead Docks that had electricity substations on the side of it. It was a Victorian street in the docks, and it had, behind these locked doors, it had electricity substations. They look like Daleks. They look lethal, you know, and it's those things of they look... They're drab coloured. They're not, you know, they just, you know that they can kill. And it's just that utter alien, you know, alien fascists, I think is the real.
So, your last voice, and a fear or phobia you live with now.
Yes.
And you said.
What did I say? What did you say? I said going mad, which is a legitimate fear, I think. And I think it covers a lot of the things that I'm scared about. Last winter, as it was heading up to Christmas, I was writing High Strangeness, which is the other thing I should mention, which is the Audible thing I did, which is I love. But it just meant I was just top down writing every single day. It was literally like 12 hours of writing. And I ended up listening to all of Pink Floyd again, which I haven't done since I was a teenager. And it struck me how much of it is... there's a lot of stuff complaining about being a millionaire, but there's a lot of stuff about going mad. I mean, the whole of Dark Side of the Moon is about things that make you go mad. And also just the stuff about Syd Barrett and things. And I was just thinking how fragile sanity is sometimes, really. It just is. It's a thing that I think I've always slightly been scared of. And I think I've come... Thank God, not in any serious way, but I think I've had episodes in my life where I've not been entirely sane. And it's unpleasant to think of that. And it's unpleasant to think that the instruments with which you use to measure the world might all be faulty. And I think that is terrifying. And I think that, you know, to be a human being is just to have, you know, you are deluded. It's a necessary state of delusion. You get up in the morning, you delude yourself that you matter on the larger scheme of things. You delude yourself that it is worth doing everything you're going to do that day. And it's like, and doing the things makes them worthwhile, and it gives them meaning, but you have to inject that meaning yourself. And it's so easy to just, that's like smoke. It can just vanish instantly. And then what are you left with? You know, it's, yeah, you're left without a flat world with no affect, or, you know, it's just a horrible thing. I think it's so close to you know, and I think it's always a couple of steps away from people, I think. I think they're not people. I don't know. I think lockdown has been very instructive for everyone in terms of what matters. And I'm playing again. I'm sorry. I'm fiddling.
That's okay.
No, people are very.
Interrupt you there. Yeah.
Sorry. I think lockdown has been instructive for people because it's forced them to focus on the things that matter. But to live in the world we live in is to live in a world of lunatics often, and it's.
Yeah.
You know, for instance, like the degradation of the natural world, which terrifies everyone. But not to the point where anyone seems to be doing anything about it or anything. There's no concerted effort to, we just march on with the same. And that's just one of the many millions of things you have to live with every day that just don't make any sense. I'm very interested in sanity as a state of mind, because I think it's very precious and very rare. I don't think that's valued enough, to be honest with you. it's a hard thing to talk about, really. But
I think you're talking about it beautifully.
Thank you. That's a nice thing to hear. Go on. No, please.
No, I have nothing to say but glib. There's nothing I could say now that wouldn't be glib. So I'm interested.
Please, honestly. I think I've come close in my life a couple of times to losing that sanity, and I don't like that. And I don't mean in any kind of hackneyed sort of "I went mad" kind of way. But you know, you do reach points where life is really tough, and it could be very easy for me here to just let go of all the things that I've learned, and it's a constant thing, I think, and it encapsulates all the other things. I mean, that's why I brought up Dark Side of the Moon, is because it's a list of things that make people go mad, like thinking about dying or thinking about money or thinking about, you know, or being in an impossible situation, all the things. But you know, they all lead to the same place, and they all lead to the fact of madness. And I find that terrifying.
I'm interested in the art of creating about madness, because obviously you couldn't make that album while in that state. So there has to be some kind of memory or documentation of that, and then it being a reflective thing.
Yes. And exactly, because Syd Barrett wasn't in a condition where he could have gone, "Well, I'm going to take a step back and look at this." Yeah. And that's terrifying. For him, it was his reality. He didn't have any way out of it. There were no exits. Whereas everyone else from the outside, they could see what was happening to him. Yeah. It was horrifying. There's not a lot you can do. You know, you can be supportive, but that's about it. So, it's just that fear, I suppose, of the, like I said, the equipment being faulty, that the thing that you need to survive has been corrupted. And I think there's so much of that around at the moment. I mean, it's pretty much running at virus speeds everywhere, really, is that everyone seems entitled now to their own delusions and their own world. And that is terrifying to me too.
More
than one person has said people now seem entitled to their own facts and their own opinions, and that is terrifying to me, that you are now, you can construct your world unchallenged, and in this little cell where it's affirmed by other people who share the same delusion. I find that very terrifying.
One thing I thought would be interesting to talk about is the use of madness and mental illness in horror movies and horror books, because it's such a well-used trope, and you sort of forget. And then I was going through the Empire list of the greatest horror movies of all time, and my own favourite horror movies, well, I was like, oh shit, they're pretty much all about someone who's mentally ill, schizophrenic, bipolar, have escaped from a lunatic asylum, all these things, or someone who is convinced they're going mad because they're seeing something supernatural.
We were talking about a link with comedy, and which we haven't done at all in the last hour, but the one,
oh fuck comedy,
the one link is the unconscious, and the fact that post Freud you can no longer have a ghost story that doesn't have that explanation in it, that people have gone nuts.
Oh, that's interesting.
So you have that, and it, you know, Turn of the Screw comes out, I think it's 1898 it comes out, could be wrong. And then Interpretation of Dreams comes out, I think 1901. But I bet both those dates are wrong. But they're all generally correct. So what you have then is they move into the psychological. I mean, you can argue that dimension was always there, but you then, it's made explicit. You then have, it might be a manifestation of the fact you've gone mad. And, you know, there are precursors to that. There's the Telltale Heart and other things, but it really becomes part of a toolkit around men, which is good. I mean, stories should evolve, you know. So
horror films, you know, the bruise that we want to prod with horror, it's just as much about am I ever going to go mad? Am I ever going to lose my mind?
What were the horror films in that list that were the...
The favourites. So I just started writing down my favourite horror films. And this is just things I've watched recently. And I had Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, Carrie, yeah. American Psycho, Halloween, St. Maud. And that all of them, Carrie is about someone's psychability, but her mum is definitely suffering from a mental illness, which may be a hereditary mental illness. But that wasn't even me thinking out, what films are about people sort of, you know, with mental issues. and why do I think that's okay? I'm so sensitive about other things, but for some reason I'm fine with mental illness being represented as, and they will also go and kill people.
I also like the stories that, this is ghost stories again, but I like the stories that take that starting point and they do something. I have to go back to The Shining just because I've always found it fascinating. I think there's a fascinating element to it. And it's not so much about a man going mad as a place that makes people go mad. And that's sort of brilliant. And also the fact that none of...
Oh, no. It's the big debate with The Shining, whether you like the film or the book, and whether Jack Nicholson, whether Jack should start off being a bad man or if it's the hotel that draws him out. And I love the movie.
Yeah.
But he starts off as a bad man who is then given permission to unravel and be worse. And that's fine.
It's really interesting because in the book, he doesn't kill anyone. He's only a danger to himself, which is why I think the film is superior in a lot of ways. Because he is, it's not as exciting in those terms to have him. You know, if he doesn't kill anyone, then he's annoying because he's a danger to himself. But yeah, I don't know, it's a funny one, that one.
Can I return to the Empire list of the top 50 films of all time? So Get Out, Am I Going Mad or Is Something Bigger Going On?
Are these people awful? Yeah.
Psycho,
there's no mental
Then you've got there's Monster, Supernatural, American Werewolf, Vampires, Ring, Zombies, and then Carrie, Rosemary's Baby, absolutely.
Yes. Yeah.
Couldn't more be. I mean, there's no monsters in it until the last. There's a woman having some bad dreams, and everything and else is, am I going mad? The gaslighting overlap between mental illness and is there ghosts is. Is that what we're actually all scared of?
I don't know. I think I just always wonder, writing ghost stories, I always wonder how you'd react if something completely preposterous happened in front of you, like something levitated or something. Like, what would you actually, what would you do? What would you think? How would you react? And it's just that sort of, because at that point, one of two things is going on. Neither of them good. But either there's something in the room in you which is causing things, or you've lost it, you've left the shore and you're drifting free.
Yes, and which is scarier, which would you rather believe?
Yeah, there's a line in the book, actually, where I said, Tim says, is it scarier to believe somewhere's haunted or that nowhere is? Yeah. I think that's a really interesting question. It's like, is it more comforting? People go, I don't believe in ghosts, but they sort of believe in life after death. It's really like, that doesn't add up. Or they don't, and it's like, it's again, with the thing we were talking about earlier about that people can, they are deluded necessarily. We are deluded. Yeah. We are people. Mm-hmm. But it often pays to not examine it too closely because it's all quite contradictory and a bit, So, yeah, it's I find it very unsettling that we don't give these things perhaps as much thought as we should.
Do you have a favourite or least favourite story of...
I think... The best is Turn of the Screw. I just think it's just so special and so brilliant. And it just is one of those things where it can be read any number of ways with equal legitimacy. You can read it and it's about a lady going mad, or it is about ghosts, and it's about violent ghosts, and it's about, it's never admits of the same reading twice. You can read that. That's what I like. I like stories where you come back, like The Shining and like Psycho. Every time I watch Psycho, it's a different film. and because you're different, and because it's more than that. It's like sometimes Psycho is hilarious. You watch it, it's very, very funny. And sometimes you watch it, it's just incredibly bleak. And both of those readings are permitted. But I think Turn of the Screw is... I haven't read Turn of the Screw in years, but I just remember it.
Have you read The Yellow Wallpaper?
Oh, I love The Yellow Wallpaper. Yeah.
I just read that recently, and I was like, oh, God, it's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing. Because it's so short, you can't even pitch the plot without without spoiling it. So just go and read it. It costs a pound. Yeah. It's like a very thin short story that you.
It's a Dover edition, isn't it?
Penguin Classic kind of thing. Yeah.
Yes. It's a wonderful story.
So good. A woman hates some wallpaper.
Yeah.
Or like, yeah, it's fucking great.
The fact that using wallpaper is interesting because in the Shining, it's the carpet. Which is the big objective correlative for you're losing your mind. And you know that carpet is horrible, but the wallpaper as well.
Can I just show you something? Wasn't planned. I'm wearing my Shining socks today.
Hey, excellent. There you go. I do love that pattern's come back.
For the listener at home, I inserted my foot.
Sarah has just shown me her socks
from quite a long way away, and
it made me uncomfortable. Yes, but that, yeah, so it's using those things and having the sense to go, if you looked at that thing for long enough, you'd go mad. And that's brilliant. I mean, it's just, I like the fact you know, that the yellow wallpaper is left up to you what that looks like, because that's your nightmare. I just do love that. I love that idea.
Yes, I do find it interesting that we accept so readily that mental illness is the start of turning into Patrick Bateman or that kind of thing. And because it's the one sort of, and I'm sure that there must be people who have, well, there are people who've written these beautiful essays on why we shouldn't let this happen in horror and we should be more sensitive and stuff like that, but I do find it rather
have a problem with that being used as a you know, I think it's very much part of the territory, and it's sort of, you know, and if you can't, it's a place where you ask interesting questions. And, you know, speaking of someone who's had mental health issues, which we're not going to go into here, I've never really even noticed it. I mean, I'd noticed it was like spectacularly offensive, but I find with genre and horror in general, the standard of storytelling tends to be higher than it is in a lot of other drama. Because it places such restrictions on what you can do and what's acceptable in terms of, it's very easy to do bad horror, and I think horror fans are very discriminating against, so when something is genuinely excellent, like you and I went to see St. Maud last week.
We did go to see St. Maud, yes, back in the time when we were allowed to mingle households, which is at home.
That's a nostalgia trip for everyone at home.
Remember when you go to the cinema with your mates? Oh, that was amazing. That was the day and a half in London.
Brilliant. It was like a masked ball.
But actually, it's the same thing. You came away from that going, oh, fuck, it's brilliant. It's feminist horror, and it's about loneliness, and was really fascinating. And actually, yeah, it does still have that same thing of people who hear voices in their head will do harm to themselves or others. And we take that as horror is normally so moralistic. Horror is normally like, if you're racist, you will get comeuppance. If you exclude people from society, or if you treat people cruelly, terrible things will happen to you. And
it's the essence of the horror story is always. Yeah. I did a lot of obviously thinking about this when I was writing the book. The essence of the horror story is always somebody does something bad and they are punished, and that's it. And what the bad thing is shifts over time, but you know. It is always that. It's, you know, there are different varieties of horror story, but it tends to be that. And it is, you're right, it's a puritanical device. But,
But don't, because it's cathartic. This is, again, going back to why we love horror so much in these dark times when...
No one gets any comeuppance of any kind. literally, there's no consequences for anybody who does anything bad anymore. So,
I won't even leave this in, but I'm now just speculating on how you flip that trope and do the Get Out version of that the person with mental illness is actually the only sane one or something. But, you know, there's something in there that's like, how do we flip that trope?
Yeah. I talked about one of my favourite examples of this. The other one I forgot to mention is They Live, which is just absolutely fantastic.
They Live! Oh, yes! But that's another Gaslight anthem, you know?
It's just marvellous. The bit where Roddy Piper comes into the bank and starts shooting everyone, you get to see it from people's perspective, and you just think, well, this guy's just gone mad. He's gone mad. And it's brilliant that it's yeah.
It's, I mean, there's those ones where as well where it's like the release of madness. Madness comes as a release, and those are those are the ones that always get under my skin and stick with me for a few days. Which is like Brazil. Oh my god.
Mm.
I mean, for all that Terry Gilliam is a terrible human being these days, he did not make some good films back in the time in the
it's
before time.
Bleak. It's so bleak, the end of Brazil. Oh, I think asking,
but yet also wonderful. And which one would you rather have?
Well, this is also. Yeah. Some Maud, I mean, from her perspective, it was all pretty great. You know, it's like, it was all, that's it.
Oh, I'd love to say more things. I'd love to say more things now. And until more people have seen St. Maud,
we can't. Yeah. It's roped off. Go and see St. Maud.
No, video on demand it or whatever. It's
whatever
really
they
good.
Have now. Yes, it's very, very, good, very good. And it's the same thing when It Follows came out. I mean, that was the other thing that lit up horror fans. And I honestly think that's the best horror film in the last 10 years, just for a lot of reasons. But also, again, an incredibly moralistic film. It can be read as a sort of, you have to have sex with someone to get rid of it. It's like, what could this be about? It's
it's subverting that trope, isn't it? I tell you what I loved about It Follows as well is that it was an original enough idea to be included in the horror genres that they did in Lovecraft Country. If you've seen it yet,
I haven't yet.
It has been my favourite thing in the world. But each episode sort of takes a very classic horror genre, you know, the haunted house, the monster movie, it really classic joke, and then it does one episode that's an It Follows episode.
Right.
Like, that is, if you've entered the pantheon of standard tropes.
very quickly as well.
Very quickly.
It took less than a decade. Yes. That's very good. Yeah.
I highly recommend anyone seeking catharsis in horror. Lovecraft Country.
Mm. I watched 10 seconds with my wife. She's like, no, not doing this.
I think that's wise.
I understand people's reaction to that. It's like, I think the minute that Cthulhu appeared, my wife's like, this is not for me.
No. I think if you don't like gore, you'll hate it. And if you love gore, you'll love it more than any gore you've ever seen. It's like the best gore. Gore with a point, always wonderful.
No, I was just going to say, the final choice I'd make for going mad horror is Hangs a Man by Shirley Jackson, which is a brilliant novel.
I didn't know that.
And, well, I think it's, I mean, I love The Haunting of Hill House. I love We've Always Lived in the Castle, but that's my favourite of her books. Just because she writes about aberrant mental states a lot. I mean, that's in every book, explicitly in things like The Bird's Nest. But most, the aberrant mental state in that book is that she's very bright, and that's enough. She's very smart, and she's surrounded by people who sort of, you know, are not well disposed to that, and it's how she copes with it and the sort of bleakness of it, and it's just a great piece of work. It really is. And it's just, and you can draw your own, again, the ending is very ambiguous and you can draw your own conclusions, but I think it's absolutely a sort of tour de force, that book.
I will seek that out. Well, I think we've covered just about everything in the world. Has been so great. Well,
thank you.
Will McLean, thank you so much for joining me and unpacking your fears with me. I've really enjoyed this conversation a lot. I hope listeners have as well. What are you working on at the moment? Have you got The Apparition Phase?
I have The Apparition Phase, which is out on, it'll be out when this is out, I think. So it's 29th of October.
29th, fantastic. So
there we go. For Halloween. It's ghost season, everyone.
It is.
Read a ghost book.
This is the spooktacular.
Yeah. I really put a lot of work into that book. I read a lot of ghost stories and I watch a lot of ghost stories, and I really, really wanted to write
Of the ghost stories. It is fantastic. It is a man obsessed by ghost stories.
I think that comes across.
I think that does come across. It's great.
And at the other end of the scale, I have, there's an Audible thing I've written called High Strangeness, which I mentioned earlier, which is one of the reviewers said a Lovecraftian comedy, which is kind of, it's a comedy
racist
drama.
Lovecraftian.
Guys, come on. It's a comedy drama, and it's about the paranormal. and it's about one of the more esoteric theories of the paranormal. It's John Keel's theory of ultra-terrestrials who are... It's the theory that all paranormal events, flying saucers, lake monsters, whatever else, are all manifestations of creatures from other realities. Mm. So that's hence it's a kind of catch-all. John Keel wrote the Mothman Prophecies, which I think is one of the great sort of cosmic Joker books. Because I'm not entirely sure how much of it is flim-flam and how much of it is real, but it's a great book. And it does kind of open your mind. You just start to think how maybe these things are practical jokers. I mean, maybe that's all they want.
Like, you know, like that's
thrilling. Maybe they're just awful. Maybe we're just on interdimensional beetles about. You know,
fantastic.
So all of that stuff's in there, and in this they're much more threatening than that. But it was so much fun to do it. It's got Sophie McShera from Downton in it, and it's got Adam James from I May Destroy You, and Anna Chancellor from loads of great things. And it's got, the cast is absolutely stellar. It's got Mandy. It's just a fantastic cast. Better than we could have hoped. Better than we could have got for television. Because it's audio. And they all brought their A game. And I love it. Honestly, I'm so happy.
So, apparition phase, high strangeness. Fantastic.
Yes,
and can you bear to be on social media? Where can people find you?
I'm on Instagram. It's probably the best place to find me. I think it's Will Mack Writing. So I just basically post spooky things that I like. Yeah, that's kind of it, really.
Mm. Awesome. Will McLean, thank you so much for joining me.
Not at all.
Happy
Halloween, everyone.
Have
a socially responsible and distanced Halloween.
Enjoy your pumpkin trails.
Stay in and use a Ouija board, something harmless like that. It'll just be fine. It'll be fine. It's a good, you know, it's a healthy distraction.
What's the worst that can happen at this point?
I mean, come on, guys.
Come on, guys.
If you're a fan of all things geeky, you're going to love Concessions, a brand new podcast by comedian Matt Hunton and myself, Beck Hill, where we interview your favourite cult heroes at Comic-Cons all across the world. We've got stars from Star Wars, Harry Potter, The Walking Dead, and more. Make sure you tune in soon to Concessions.